This is Audible.
Dreamscape presents Always Running by Luis Rodriguez. Copyright 1993 and 2005 by Luis Rodriguez. This audiobook was recorded by arrangement with Touchstone, a division of Simon & Schuster. Read by the author.
The Long Run, New Introduction to Always Running. My task is to make you hear, to make you feel, and above all, to make you see. That is all, and it is everything. Joseph Conrad. What's happened in the 17 years since Always Running first hit the bookstands? After getting arrested in 1997, my son Ramiro, for whom I wrote the book, was eventually sentenced to 28 years for 3 counts of attempted murder. With good time, however, he was released in July 2010 after 13 and a half years. More of my homies from 40 years ago have died, including Rene Munoz Ledo, who wrote a family-produced book, Forgiven, about overcoming his gang and drug experiences before succumbing to cancer in 2004. The Chicago youth I started to work with right after the book's publication through Youth Struggling for Survival, YSS, continue to organize and thrive, many with families, jobs, and a business or two, although some have been killed or imprisoned. Good and bad things have occurred, but the good, young people changing their lives, the growth of organized urban peace efforts, the expansion of spiritual-based practices, and the intensifying debate on how to address violence in this country have far outweighed the bad. I've gone to hundreds of public and private schools to speak. In Boston's Hyde Park, the mostly African-American students there created a ballet and a rap song based on the book. In East Lansing's Eastern High, where Black and Mexican youth have been warring, Always Running became the one thing they could unite on. A student there painted a mural in the school library with scenes from the book. In East LA's Garfield High, Chicano students established an after-school study circle to become intellectually engaged and politically active based on what they learned from the book. I visited numerous prisons, juvenile detention centers, sober living homes, and rehabilitation centers. I've read my poems in the maximum security yard at San Quentin Prison as prisoners talked, worked out with weights, played chess, and jogged. Oh, and quite a few stopped to listen. In one California prison, I saw a homeboy I had not seen in 30 years. All that time he'd been in prison. He told me, whatever you do, help the kids. I've met court judges who made reading my book part of offenders' sentences. I've addressed thousands of teachers, law enforcement personnel, social workers, community organizers, journalists, government officials, graduate students, writers, and others in countless workshops, peace summits, and forums. I've appeared on major media programs as the Oprah Winfrey Show, Good Morning America, PBS's News Hour with Jim Lehrer, BBC London, NBC's Nightly News with Brian Williams, CNN's What Matters, Headline News's Leaders with Heart, History Channel's and Spike TV's Gangland, and ESPN's 30 for 30, including shows in Spanish language TV and radio. My work in 20 years has taken me to Toronto, Montreal, Paris, London, Manchester, Rome, Milan, Berlin, Hamburg, Frankfurt, Cologne, Erlangen, Heidelberg, Stuttgart, Southern Germany, Amsterdam, Groningen, Salzburg, Mexico City, Guadalajara, Chihuahua, El Salvador, Guatemala, Puerto Rico, Peru, Venezuela, Tokyo, and Sarajevo, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. For almost 20 years, I've taken part in purification ceremonies in Native American and Native Mexican sweat lodges called Inipis or Temazcalis, with gang and other troubled youth, as well as recovering adults, with longtime spiritual friends Luis Ruan, Frank Blasquez, my brother-in-law Hector Herrera, my wife Trini, and with elder medicine men like Anthony Lee of the Navajo Reservation and Ed, young man afraid of his horse in the Pine Ridge Reservation. This work is about the long run, not just for today, for any possible accolades or to meet funding deadlines, but for the adequate and full protection, health and balance, as Native elders say, of our young people 7 generations from now. In spite of this, Always Running has become a lightning rod for certain right-wing groups who are trying to stop its use in schools because of the book's politics and graphic nature. According to the American Library Association, it is one of the 100 most censored books in the United States. In Rockford, Illinois, I debated a prominent school board member lobbying to ban the book to an overflow audience of mostly book supporters. In San Jose, California, I wrote an opinion piece to counter the efforts there to remove the book from approved reading lists. In Chicago, I addressed leaders of a group of 200 students who had walked out of their school to protest the removal of the book from the school library. One strange incident occurred in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I was speaking at various schools and community events in the area. At one point, I tried to enter school with Always Running in hand. School officials stopped me at the entrance, saying I could come in, but my book could not. It had been banned in that school. As I see it, the battle lines are between the idealized, superficial, and insular-minded way of looking at the world, which many schools and mainstream culture impose on our children and the rest of us, and the actual conditions of our lives with all its multiplicity, struggle, shading, and nuance. Most children recognize the hypocrisy of emphasizing a linear, clean, and desexed path while they confront daily the muddy, uncertain, and hybrid truths. Sexuality, for example, is a natural part of human development. Books don't cause teenagers to become sexual. Hormones do. Instead of providing understanding and badly needed guidance to teenagers when the hormones kicked in, too often they are told sex is wrong, that it shouldn't be addressed until they mature, instead of preparing them so they do mature, and that there's only one way of looking at sex and other disturbing topics like race, class, and power, mostly by denying their existence. The truth is much more complex. There's too much censorship of reality in the classroom. Whatever involves social discomfort, emotional depth, or hard thinking is cut out. Language, behavior, ideas, ways of expression, and authentic imaginations, as well as books, have been censored. Everything is directed toward normalcy, the folding into the fast-paced material and status-oriented capitalist value system. As a result, much of the expanse and variety of the human condition is belittled or invalidated. Our humanity is sacrificed little by little. Despite this, Always Running continues to be requested and used. I've been told countless times that this is one of the few books non-readers love to read, and that it is often the most stolen book in libraries and classrooms. I don't condone this, although it usually happens in places where there are no bookstores or decent library facilities. Yes, Always Running is hardcore. Yes, it's graphic. It's meant to be this way. You can't tell this true story about real gang life without the graphic details. Many kids who love the book have also lived through similar experiences. Too many adults are naive or closed-minded about what their children are going through. The thing is, Always Running was a book that had to be written. It's the first major account of the Chicano Barrio gang experience from an actual participant, unlike the many sociological studies by social scientists. After more than 100 years of L.A. barrio warfare, thousands killed, several generations of gang families, parents who lost 2 or 3 sons, this story had to be told. I can't claim Always Running is representative of the vastly multifaceted Chicano gang life. I can only take responsibility for the truths I felt compelled to reveal, with the necessary changes in facts and names to protect the innocent and the guilty. Like any good story, there are deep lessons, most of which I learned the hard way. My life on the streets involved stealing, shooting, stabbings, arrests, homelessness, drug use, and overdoses. I've been beaten and shot at, although never hit, and I've beaten, stabbed, and shot at others. I felt too far gone to be redeemed, to be any good to anyone or anything. I didn't have plans for a future, for a career, or the dreams to take me there. You'll find all this and more in Always Running. At the same time, you'll also discover the transcendent account of a poet-artist who, with the help of a small, socially engaged core of community leaders and teachers, overcame his own deeply held pathologies to take on the great challenges of an oppressive and exploitative reality, and finding his own particular destiny with words, dedicated himself to making positive contributions in transforming that reality. I went from victim to perpetrator to witness to revolutionary. Close to 40 years later, I continue to do the vital work of helping create a healthy earth and a healthy society worthy of our gifts, our needs, and our dreams, which is the ultimate struggle, the one fight really worth fighting. I have a duty to take those lessons and experiences to as many people as will listen, to expand the conversation about why people join gangs, are violent, lose their imaginations and their hopes, and to explore what we can do as creative and caring communities to truly see and address these ongoing and deepening concerns. Censorship, repression, and suppression simply don't work. All our creativity, poetic expression, access to life-giving resources, truly meaningful and respectful relationships, purposeful and life-affirming schooling and work, jobs and more jobs, decent health care, drug and psychiatric treatment as needed, and truly rehabilitative and initiatory practices are a few of the things that do work. But the political will and narrowing economic resources, as well as the cultural values of our present time, have not fostered the growth or taken up the responsibility of healing a nation. Prisons and war seem to be the only way out for most poor and abandoned communities. We have the technological means. We have the people. We have the ideas. We don't have the proper social organization. No one can stand gangs. Everyone wants to get rid of them. But the solid and necessary work that will actually delve into the social, political, psychological, economic, and spiritual basis for gangs, drug addictions, as well as domestic and street violence is not being done. To paraphrase Henry David Thoreau, thousands are hacking at the branches of the problem. Few are working at the root. While it's true, many organizations, churches, unions, neighborhood councils, native sweat lodge circles, community centers, arts programs, poetry circles, hip-hop organizations, and mentoring groups continue to transform lives among the most hardcore gang youth, there are still tens of thousands more young people, most not even in gangs, who are being abandoned, pushed aside, condemned to prison, drug addictions, or early deaths. Ramiro is one of the statistics. Although he's not a number to me, he's my son. I have discussed extensively in writing, in the media, and in front of countless audiences my particular contribution to Ramiro's breakdown and eventual imprisonment. Essentially, I neglected Ramiro and my daughter Andrea after their mom and I broke up. Years later, when they came to live with me in Chicago, they were resentful, pissed off teenagers. As one can imagine, I had a hard time trying to be the father figure they desperately needed. Even still, there are those who have made Ramiro's ordeal a focal point to attack me and my book. How can I claim my book has changed lives when my own son is incarcerated? Doesn't this prove these kids aren't worthy of help? My answer would be an emphatic no. As Ramiro's father, I had no choice but to step up to the plate, to become the father I should have been when my children were younger. But I was also in the process of healing. After many failed tries, I finally took part in a recovery program and became sober after 7 years of drug use and 20 years of drinking, a sobriety I have maintained for more than 17 years since mid-1993. Now, I had no excuses. I could focus on my son's ordeals. I could be a better husband, friend, father, and leader. Always Running contributed immensely to my personal healing. Writing about my violent gang life, the drug addictions, the rages, and fears proved to be risky and extremely difficult, but deeply cathartic. Eventually, I reconciled with Ramiro, now 35, even while he was in prison in various Illinois Department of Corrections facilities. I couldn't bail him out of the trouble he was in, but I wouldn't abandon him either. I've promised to stand by him and provide whatever assistance he needs to become strong and wise from his experience. He promised he would do well so he could get out with good time, and that's exactly what he did. Now on parole, but in the world, he wants to be a father to his three teenage children and an active participant in the communities of imagination and hope we've been working hard toward. At great risk, he left the gang life and drugs. Recently, Ramiro wrote, "When Always Running was first written, it opened my eyes to some of the things you have experienced and some of the changes you have made in your life. Things would have been a lot worse for me if you did not try to make an effort to help me escape from some of the craziness. I am grateful for you always being there for me. Even when we did not get along and our relationship was estranged, you still stayed a presence in my life. We accomplished a lot together, and one of those accomplishments was YSS. It helped us to stay connected. Ironically, my coming to prison is what helped us to become closer. We finally have a true father and son relationship. That should be a new message for fathers from your book. Don't wait until your son goes to prison to finally get to know him." I've learned a lot from Ramiro. It wasn't always me who did the teaching. I've come a long way since Always Running first saw the light of day. But this journey would not have been possible without the immense patience, love, and support of my wonderful family, my wife Trini, our two sons, Ruben, 22, and Luis, 16, my 33-year-old daughter, Andrea, and my grandchildren, Ricardo, Anastasia, Amanda, and Catalina. Also, I have to recognize my mother, Maria Stella. Despite years of not talking to each other, in a battle with cancer that she'd overcome, we finally reconciled 8 years before she passed on in October 2008. My father died in 1992 before Always Running came out. And I want to acknowledge my brothers and sisters, nephews and nieces, and countless uncles, aunts, and cousins. A few of them had problems when my book was first published, but in time became my biggest fans. I also have to thank Alexander Taylor, Judith Doyle, and the board and staff at Curbstone Press, who first published Always Running and continue to support my work, as well as the publishers and editors of Touchstone Books, Simon & Schuster, who have kept the paperback version of Always Running in print, more than 35 printings as of this writing. Alexander Taylor also passed, and he will be sorely missed. There has rarely been a better friend to writers. And I thank all the teachers, librarians, parents, students, law enforcement officers, judges, booksellers, writers, rehab counselors, and community activists who have ensured my books remain on the shelves in the hands of young people and have also helped in fighting the censorship attempts, allowing new generations to enjoy and learn from this story. I was not a good father or a good son, but I learned. I was not a good poet, but I never stopped writing. I couldn't put two words together when I spoke, but now no one can shut me up. I had a hard time dealing with my addictions, my rages, but somehow, some way, I overcame them. The fact is, I failed at everything I tried to do, but I kept working at it, failing some more, not giving up, so that eventually, at age 56, I've begun to center my life, get control over my destructive impulses, and become someone my wife, my kids, my grandchildren, and my community can learn from and respect. If always running didn't help anybody, at least it brought miracles and magic into my life. It saved me. And this is good. Let me tell you, this is really good. When I can appreciate the stillness of the morning instead of endure the screams in my head. When I don't have to lose myself to the slow suicide of drugs and alcohol as I've done for 27 years. When I can be thankful and humble before the world, before our immense tasks as revolutionary thinkers and doers, not just for the present, but for the long run, 7 generations hence. This is good. Let me tell you, this is really good. Luis J. Rodriguez, Spring, 2011. Always running. There is no absolute peril except for him who abandons himself. There is no complete death except for him who acquires a taste for dying. Jacques Ravier. Preface to 1993 edition. We have the right to lie, but not about the heart of the matter. Antonin Artaud. Late winter Chicago, early 1991. The once white snow which fell in December had turned into a dark scum, mixed with ice melting salt, car oil, and decay. Icicles hung from rooftops and windowsills like the whiskers of old men. For months, the bone-chilling hawk swooped down and forced everyone in the family to squeeze into a 1.5-bedroom apartment in a graystone 3-flat building in the Humble Park neighborhood. Inside, tensions built up like fever as we crammed around the TV set or kitchen table, the crowding made more intolerable because of heaps of paper, open file drawers, and shelves packed with books that garnered every section of empty space, a sort of writer's torture chamber. The family included my third wife, Trini, our child, Ruben Joaquin, born in 1988, and my 15-year-old son, Ramiro. A 13-year-old daughter, Andrea, lived with her mother in East Los Angeles. We hardly ventured outside. Few things were worth heaving on the layers of clothing and the coats, boots, and gloves we required to step out the door. Ramiro had been placed on punishment, but not for an act of disobedience or the usual outburst of teenage anxiety. Ramiro had been on a rapidly declining roller coaster ride into the world of street gang America. Not unexpected for this neighborhood, once designated as one of the 10 poorest in the country and also known as one of the most gang-infested. Humble Park is a predominantly Puerto Rican community where growing numbers of Mexican immigrants and uprooted blacks and sprinklings of Ukrainians and Poles from previous generations. But along with the greater Westtown area, it was considered a changing neighborhood, dotted here and there with rehabs, signs of gentrification, and for many of us, imminent displacement. Weeks before, Ramiro had received a 10-day suspension from Roberto Clemente High School, a beleaguered school with a good number of caring personnel, but one which was an epicenter of gang activity. The suspension came after a school fight which involved a war between insanes and maniacs. Two factions of the Folks. Folks are those gangs allied with the Spanish Cobras and Gangster Disciples. The People are gangs tied to the Latin Kings and Vice Lords, symbolic of the complicated structures most inner-city gangs had come to establish. There was also an SOS, a smash-on-site contract issued on Ramiro. As a result, I took him out of Clemente and enrolled him in another school. He lasted less than 2 weeks before school officials there kicked him out. By then, I also had to pick him up from local jails following other fighting incidents, and once from a hospital where I watched a doctor put 11 stitches above his eye. Following me, Ramiro was a second-generation gang member. My involvement was in the late 1960s and early 1970s in Los Angeles, the so-called gang capital of the country. My teen years were ones of drugs, shootings, and beatings and arrests. I was around when South Central Los Angeles gave birth to the Crips and Bloods. By the time I turned 18 years old, 25 of my friends had been killed by rival gangs, police, drugs, car crashes, and suicides. If I had barely survived all this, to emerge eventually as a journalist, publisher, critic, and poet, it appeared unlikely my own son would make it. I had to begin the long, intense struggle to save his life from the gathering storm of street violence sweeping the country, some 20 years after I sneaked out of my hood in the dark of night, hid out in an LA housing project, and removed myself from the death fires of La Vida Loca. La Vida Loca, or the crazy life, is what we called the barrio gang experience. This lifestyle originated with the Mexican Pachuco gangs of the 1930s and 1940s, and was later recreated with the Cholos. It became the main model and influence for outlaw bikers of the 1950s and 1960s, the LA punk rock scene in the 1970s and 1980s, and the Crips and Bloods of the 1980s and early 1990s. As Leon Bean commented in her 1991 book, Do or Die, HarperCollins, it was the Cholo homeboy who first walked the walk and talked the talk. It was the Mexican-American Pachuco who initiated the emblematic tattoos, the signing with hands, the writing of legends on walls. One evening that winter, after Ramiro had come in late following weeks of trouble at school, I gave him an ultimatum. Yelling burst back and forth between the walls of our humbled park flat. 2-year-old Ruben, confused and afraid, hugged my leg as the shouting erupted. In moments, Ramiro ran out of the house, entering the cold Chicago night without a jacket. I went after him, although by my mid-30s, I had gained enough weight to slow me down considerably. Still, I sprinted down the gangway, which led to the debris-strewn alley filled with furniture parts and overturned trash cans. I saw Ramiro's fleeting figure, his breath rising above him in quickly dissipating clouds. I followed him toward Augusta Boulevard, the main drag of the neighborhood. People yelled out of windows and doorways, ¿Qué pasa, hombre? Others offered information on Ramiro's direction. A father or mother chasing some child down the street is not an unfamiliar sight around here. A city like Chicago has so many places in which to hide. The gray and brown brick buildings seemed to suck people in. Ramiro would make a turn and then vanish, only to pop up again, appearing and disappearing. He flew over brick walls, scurried down another alley, then veered into a building that swallowed him up and sped him out on the other side. I kept after Ramiro until, unexpectedly, I found him hiding in some bushes. He stepped out, unaware I was to the side of him. "Ramiro, come home," I gently implored, knowing if I pounced on him, there would be little hope he'd come back. He sped off again. "Leave me alone," he yelled. As I watched his escape, it was like looking back into a distant time, back to my own youth, when I ran and ran, when I jumped over peeling fences, fleeing vatos locos, the police, or my own shadow in some drug-induced hysteria. I saw Ramiro run off, and then saw my body entering the mouth of darkness, my breath cutting the frigid flesh of night. It was my voice cracking open the winter sky. Ramiro was born just prior to my 21st birthday. I had been working in a steel mill in Los Angeles. His mother, Camila, not yet 19, was an East Los Angeles woman who grew up in one of East LA's roughest barrios. Yet Camila and her five sisters, with the help of their mother, managed to stave off attempts to pull them into the street life there, even having battles on the front porch with the locas who tried to recruit them. The media likens Los Angeles to a Beirut by the beach. For 1991, police cited these statistics: 100,000 gang members, 800 gangs, nearly 600 young people killed. Parts of the city, particularly the public housing projects, have been called ungovernable. These stats have been used to create a hysteria against Black and Latino youth. Police in LA have practically instituted martial law in the inner city. Michael Davis, in his book City of Courts, Verso Press, 1991, says that by 1990, the various law enforcement operations to destroy gangs using helicopters, infrared lights, and made-over armored vehicles, not far behind what was used in 1991's Desert Storm, detained or arrested 50,000 youth in South Central alone. The crazy life in my youth, although devastating, was only the beginning stages of what I believe is now a consistent and growing genocidal level of destruction, predicated on the premise there are marginalized youth with no jobs or future, and therefore expendable. Camila's brothers weren't spared. One of them became active in a rival gang and later a heroin addict and a convict. Another brother got jumped and stabbed 7 times, but survived. And an older half-brother was killed while trying to exact some revenge one night near the Mexican border. Later, her nephews from an older sister got involved in the gangs, and one of them was murdered outside his home at the age of 17. But not before he fathered a baby. When Ramiro was 2 years old and his sister only 10 months, Camila and I broke up. About 7 years later, I moved to Chicago. After being left behind, Ramiro failed miserably in school, although he had been tested as a gifted child. He ran away from home a number of times. Once, when he was about 10 years old, he hopped a train from L.A. to Chicago, but police pulled him out of a boxcar before he passed the city limits. When he turned 13 years old, he came to stay with me. Because of what Camila and I had been through, we tried everything we could to keep him out of the life, even after we divorced and lived a couple of thousands of miles apart. But often, there was too much against us. In East L.A., and in schools like Chicago's Clemente, were some of the nation's highest dropout rates. Youth unemployment hovered around 75% in the most neglected areas. And what of those who did everything right, got all the good grades, and followed the rules? Camila, for example, had been an A student at Garfield High School, site of the 1988 movie Stand and Deliver, and was active in school fairs, but after we married, she applied for work and was told she didn't know enough to get a basic 9-to-5 office job. She even had to go back to some classes to make up for the lack of schooling she received, despite being one of the best students at Garfield. The fact that Ellie's schools now give warranties only underscores this point. With little productive to do, drug selling becomes a lucrative means of survival. A 10-year-old in Humboldt Park can make $80 to $100 a day as a lookout for local dealers. The drug trade is business. It's capitalism. Cutthroat, profit-motivated, and expedient. Also, the values which drive gangs are linked to the control markets in a way similar to what has created borders between nations. In communities with limited resources, like Humboldt Park and East LA, sophisticated survival structures evolved, including gangs, out of the bone and sinew tossed up by this environment. After Ramiro ran away, he failed to return home for another 2 weeks. I was so angry at him for leaving. I bought locks to keep him out. I kept a vigil at home to catch him should he sneak in to eat. But then I remembered what I had been through. I recalled how many institutions and people had failed my son. And now he was expected to rise above all this? Soon I spent every night he was gone, driving around the streets, talking to the boys in their street corner domains, making daily calls to the police. I placed handwritten notes in the basement which said it was okay for him to come back. I left food for him to get to. Suddenly, every teenage Latino male looked like Ramiro. With the help of some of his friends, I finally found Ramiro in a run-down barrio hovel and convinced him to come home. He agreed to obtain help in getting through some deep emotional and psychological problems, stemming in large part from an unstable childhood, including abuse he sustained as a kid from his stepfathers, one who was an alcoholic and another who regularly beat him. And I could not remove myself from being struck by the hammerhead of responsibility. A key factor was my relative lack of involvement in Ramiro's life, as I became increasingly active in politics and writing. Although the best way to deal with one's own children is to help construct the conditions that will ensure the free and healthy development of all, it's also true you can't be for all children if you can't be for your own. By mid-1991, Ramiro had undergone a few months in a psychiatric hospital and various counseling and family sessions that also involved bringing his mother in from LA. We implemented an educational and employment plan, worked out with school officials, teachers, and social workers. Everyone who had dealings with him had to be involved to get them on our side, so to speak. I also learned a parent cannot just turn over a child to a school, a court, or hospital without stepping in at various times to ensure his or her best interests are being met. My aim was to help Ramiro get through his teenage years with a sense of empowerment and esteem, with what I call complete literacy, the ability to participate competently and confidently in any level of society one chooses. There is an aspect of suicide in young people whose options have been cut off. They stand on street corners, flashing hand signs, inviting the bullets. It's either la torcida or death, a warrior's path when even self-preservation is not at stake. And if they murder, the victims are usually the ones who look like them, the ones closest to who they are, the mere reflections. They murder and they're killing themselves over and over. At the same time, Individual efforts must be linked with social ones. I tried to get Ramiro to understand the systematic nature of what was happening in the street, which in effect made choices for him before he was born. The thing is, no matter what one does individually in this setting, the dangers keep lurking around every corner. A couple of examples help Ramiro see the point. Not long ago, a few of his friends were picked up by police who drove them around in a squad car. The police took them to a rival gang neighborhood. There, they forced Ramiro's friends to spray paint over the graffiti with their own insignias as rival gang members watched, and then left them there to find their way home. It's an old police practice. A second incident involved the shooting death of a dragon, a Puerto Rican teenager named Efrain, who Ramiro knew. Soon after, we happened to drive through a Latin Kings territory. The words "Efrain rots" had been emblazoned on a wall. That night, Ramiro sat alone, intensely quiet, in the backyard, thinking about this for a long time. Things between us for now are being dealt with day by day. Although Ramiro has gained a much more viable perspective on his place in the world, there are choices he has to make, not just once, but every time they come up. Meanwhile, I've pursued writing this book after 10-year lapse. The writing first began when I was 15, but the urgency of the present predicament demands it finally see the light of day. This work is an argument for the reorganization of American society, not where a few benefit at the expense of the many, but where everyone has access to decent health care, clothing, food, and housing, based on need, not whether they can afford them. It's an indictment against the use of deadly force, which has been the principal means this society uses against those it cannot accommodate. As I write this, Rodney King's beating by the LAPD continues to play itself out throughout the country. And the Los Angeles Daily News in late October 1991 reported that the L.A. County Sheriff's Department had shot 57 people since the first of the year. About 80% were people of color, and a few were disabled or mentally ill. All of them were unarmed or shot in the back. Criminality in this country is a class issue. Many of those warehoused in overcrowded prisons can be properly called criminals of want. Those who've been deprived of the basic necessities of life and therefore forced into so-called criminal acts to survive. Many of them just don't have the means to buy their justice. They are members of a social stratum which includes welfare mothers, housing project residents, immigrant families, the homeless, and unemployed. This book is part of their story. Although the work begins with my family's trek from Mexico when I was a child and touches on our early years in Watts, it primarily covers the period from ages 12 until 18 when I became active in Las Lomas Barrio. This work is not fiction, yet there are people I don't want to hurt by having their names and stories made public. I've changed names and synthesize events and circumstances in keeping with the integrity of a literary dramatic work, as an artist does in striving for that rare instance when, as a critic once said, something of beauty collides with something of truth. The more we know, the more we know. This is a responsibility I take seriously. My hope in producing this work is that perhaps there's a thread to be found, a pattern or connection, a seed of apprehension herein, which can be of some use, no matter how slight, in helping to end the rising casualty count for the Ramiros of this world, as more and more communities come under the death grip of what we called the crazy life. July 1992. Chapter 1. Cry, child, for those without tears have a grief which never ends. Mexican saying. This memory begins with flight. A 1950s Bondo Spackle Dodge surged through a driving rain, veering around the potholes and upturned tracks of the abandoned red line trains on Alameda. Mama was in the front seat. My father was at the wheel. My brother Ronald and I sat on one end of the back seat. My sisters Pata and Cuca on the other. There was a space between the boys and girls to keep us apart. Amá, mira, Rano, a voice said for the 10th time from the back of the car. He's hitting me again. We fought all the time. My brother especially had it in for La Pata. Thinking of Frankenstein, he called her Anna Stein. Her real name was Anna. But most of the time, we went by the animal names Dad gave us at birth. I am Grillo, which means cricket. Rano stands for Rana, the frog. La Pata is the duck. And Cuca is short for cucaracha, cockroach. The car seats came apart in strands. I looked out at the passing cars, which seemed like ghosts with headlights rushing past the streaks of water on the glass. I was 9 years old. As the rain fell, my mother cursed in Spanish, intermixed with pleas to saints and La Santísima Madre de Dios. She argued with my father. Dad didn't curse or raise his voice. He just stated the way things were. I'll never go back to Mexico, he said. I'd rather starve here. You want to stay with me? It has to be in Los Angeles. Otherwise, go. This incited my mother to greater fits. We were on the way to the Union train station in downtown L.A. We had our few belongings stuffed into the trunk and underneath our feet. I gently held on to one of the comic books Mama bought to keep us entertained. I had on my Sunday best clothes with chewed gum stuck in a coat pocket. It could have been Easter, but it was a weeping November. I don't remember for sure why we were leaving. I just knew it was a special day. There was no fear or concern on my part. We were always moving. I looked at the newness of the comic book and felt some exhilaration of its feel in my hand. Mama had never bought us comic books before. It had to be a special day. For months, we had been pushed from one house to another, just Mama and us children. Mom and Dad had split up prior to this. We stayed at the homes of women my mom called comadres, with streams of children of their own. Some nights we slept in the car or in the living rooms of people we didn't know. There were no shelters for homeless families. My mother tried to get us settled somewhere, but all indications pointed to our going back to the land of her birth, to her red earth, her Mexico. The family consisted of my father Alfonso, my mom Maria Estela, my older brother Jose René, and my younger sisters Ana Virginia and Gloria Estela. I recall my father with his wavy hair and clean-shaven face, his correct, upright, and stubborn demeanor, in contrast to my mother who was heavy-set with native features and thick, straight hair, often laughing heartily, her eyes narrowed to slits, and sometimes crying from a deep, tomb-like place with a sound like swallowing mud. As we got closer to the Union Station, Los Angeles loomed low and large, a city of odd construction, a good place to get lost in. I, however, would learn to hide in imaginative worlds, in books, in TV shows where I picked up much of my English, in solitary play with mangled army men and crumpled toy trucks. I was so withdrawn, it must have looked scary. This is what I know. When I was 2 years old, our family left Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua, for Los Angeles. My father was an educated man, unusual for a border town, a hunger city filled to the hills with cardboard hovels of former peasants, Indians, and dust-faced children. In those days, an educated man had to be careful about certain things, questioning authority, for example. Although the principal of a local high school, my father failed to succumb to the local chieftains who were linked to the National Party which ruled Mexico, as one famous Latin American writer would later say, with a perfect dictatorship. When Dad first became principal, there were no funds due to the massive bureaucratic maze he had to get through to get them. The woman he lived with then was an artist who helped raise money for the school by staging exhibitions. My father used his own money to pay for supplies, and at one point had the iron fence around the school torn down and sold for scrap. One year, Dad received an offer for a six-month study program for foreign teachers in Bloomington, Indiana. He liked it so much he renewed it 3 times. By then, my father had married his secretary, my mother, after the artist left them. They had their first child, Jose René. By the time my father returned, his enemies had mapped out a means to remove him. Being a high school principal is a powerful position in a place like Ciudad Juarez. My father faced a pile of criminal charges, including the alleged stealing of school funds. Police arrived at the small room in the vecindad where Mama and Dad lived and escorted him to the city jail. For months, my father fought the charges. While he was locked up, they fed him scraps of food in a rusted steel can. They denied him visitors. Mama had to climb a section of prison wall and pick up 2-year-old Jose René so he could see his father. Finally, after a lengthy trial, my father was found innocent, but he no longer had his position as principal. Dad became determined to escape to the United States. My mother, on the other hand, never wanted to leave Mexico. She did it to be with Dad. Mama was one of 2 daughters and a family run by heavy-drinking, wife-beating railroad worker and musician. My mother was the only one in her family to complete high school. Her brothers Kiko and Rodolfo often crossed the border to find work and came back with stories of love and bras on the other side. Their grandmother was a Tarahumara Indian who once walked down from the mountainous area in the state of Chihuahua where her people lived in seclusion for centuries. The Spanish never conquered them, but their grandmother never returned to her people. She eventually gave birth to my grandmother, Ana Costa. Ana's first husband was a railroad worker during the Mexican Revolution. He lost his life when a tunnel exploded during a raid. They brought his remains in a shoebox-sized container. Ana was left alone with 1 son while pregnant with a daughter. Luisita, the daughter, eventually died of convulsions at the age of 4. And Manolo, the son, was later blinded after a bout with a deadly form of chickenpox, which struck and killed many children in the area. Later, Ana married my grandfather, Monico Jimenez, who, like her first husband, worked the railroads. At one point, Monico quit the rails to play trumpet and sing for bands in various nightclubs. Once, he ended up in Los Angeles, but with another woman. In fact, Monico had many other women. My grandmother often had to cross over to the railroad yards, crowded with prostitutes, and where Monico spent many nights singing to bring him home. When my parents married, Mama was 27, Dad almost 40. She had never known any other man. He already had 4 or 5 children from 3 or 4 other women. She was an emotionally charged border woman, full of fire, full of pain, full of giving love. He was a stoic, unfeeling, unmoved intellectual who did as he pleased as much as she did all she could to please him. This dichotomous couple, this sun and moon, this curandera and biologist, dreamer and realist, fire woman and water man, molded me. These two sides created a lifelong conflict in my breast. By the time Dad had to leave Ciudad Juarez, my mother had borne three of his children, including myself, all in El Paso, on the American side. Gloria was born later in East LA's General Hospital. This was done to help ease the transition from alien status to legal residency. There are stories of women who wait up to the ninth month and run across the border to have their babies, sometimes squatting and dropping them on the pavement as they hug the closest lamppost. We ended up in Watts, a community primarily of black people, except for La Colonia, often called the Quarter, the Mexican section and the oldest part of Watts. Except for the housing projects, Watts was a ghetto where country and city mixed. The homes were mostly single-family units made of wood or stucco. Open windows and doors served as air conditioners, a slight relief from the summer desert air. Chicken coops graced many a backyard along with broken auto parts. Roosters crowed the morning to birth, and an occasional goat peered from weather-worn picket fences along with the millions of dogs which seemed to populate the neighborhood. Watts fed into one of the largest industrial concentrations in the country, pulling from an almost endless sea of cheap labor. They came from Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Arkansas, from Chihuahua, Sonora, Sinaloa, and Nayarit. If you moved there, it was because the real estate concerns pushed you in this direction. For decades, LA was notorious for restrictive covenants, where some areas were off-limits to undesirables. Despite the competition for jobs and housing, we found common ground there, among the rolling mills, bucket shops, and foundries. All day long, we heard the pounding of forges and their air whistles that signaled the shift changes in the factories which practically lay in our backyards. We moved to Watts at the behest of my oldest sister, really a half-sister, who was already married with two children of her own. Her family eventually joined us a few months later. Her name was Senny, a name my father invented, although rumor has it, it was an inversion of the name Inez, an old girlfriend of his. The name, however, has stayed in the family. Senny's first daughter was named Anna Senny, and in later years, one of Anna Senny's daughters became Senny B. When Senny was a child, my father often left her for long intervals with my grandmother, Gatita, whom she called Mama Piri. One family legend tells of a 9-year-old Senny answering the door during the pouring rain. A man with soaked hat and coat stood at the doorway. Senny yelled out, "Mama Piri, Mama Piri, there's a strange man at the door." "Don't worry, mija," Gatita said. "He's only your father." Senny lived in several rentals in Watts until she found a two-story on 111th Street near a block of factories. The place later got razed to build Locke High School. I stayed there a couple of summers sleeping in a cobweb-infested attic with exposed 2x4 studs. Rats and cockroaches roamed freely in that house. Huge rats, huge cockroaches. Senny would place a chair at the bottom of the attic steps, and she convinced me it would ward off the creatures. I believed it until one night I noticed the chair was gone. I ran down to tell Senny, but she yelled back in Spanish, "Go back to bed. That chair couldn't keep nothing away, and only a fool would believe it could." I was devastated. Senny was my father's daughter from one of his earlier relationships. Her mother died giving birth to her. My father was handsome and athletic as a young man. He was the pole vaulting champion of one of the schools he attended. but his looks apparently got him into a lot of trouble. His father, Cristobal, then a general in the Mexican army, once disowned him when Dad fell for a woman and neglected his studies in medical school. Dad quit school to be with the woman, who would later become Sandy's mother. I also had two older half-brothers, Alberto and Mario, who lived in Mexico. Another half-sister, Lisa, died as an infant after she accidentally ate some chicharrones my father was forced to sell on cobblestone streets in Mexico City after his father cut him off. My mother kept a sepia-colored black and white death photo of Lisa in a white lace baptism dress, looking like a doll, looking asleep, so peaceful as he lay in a tiny wood coffin. Our first exposure in America stays with me like a foul odor. It seemed a strange world, most of it spiteful to us, spitting and stepping on us, coughing us up, us immigrants, as if we were phlegm stuck in the collective throat of this country. My father was mostly out of work. When he did have a job, it was in construction, and factories such as Sinclair Paints or Standard Brand's dog food, or pushing doorbells selling insurance, Bibles, or pots and pans. My mother found work cleaning homes or in the garment industry. She knew the corner markets were ripping her off, but she could only speak with her hands and in a choppy English. Once my mother gathered up the children and we walked to Will Rogers Park, there were people everywhere. Mama looked around for a place we could rest. She spotted an empty spot on a park bench. But as soon as she sat down, an American woman with three kids of her own came by. "Hey, get out of there. That's our seat." My mother understood, but didn't know how to answer back in English. So she tried in Spanish. "Look, Spick, you can't sit there," the American woman yelled. "You don't belong here, understand? This is not your country." Mama quietly got her things and walked away. But I knew frustration and anger bristled within her because she was unable to talk. And when she did, no one would listen. We never stopped crossing borders. The Rio Grande, or Rio Bravo, which is what the Mexicans call it, given the name a power Rio Grande just doesn't have, was only the first of countless barriers set in our path. We kept jumping hurdles, kept breaking from the constraints, kept evading the border guards of every new trek. It was a metaphor to fill our lives, that river, that first crossing, the mother of all crossings. The Alley River, for example, became a new barrier, keeping the Mexicans in their neighborhoods over on the vast east side of the city for years, except for forays downtown. Schools provided other restrictions. Don't speak Spanish. Don't be Mexican. You don't belong. Railroad tracks divided us from communities where white people lived, such as Southgate and Linwood across from Watts. We were invisible people in a city which thrived on glitter, big screens, and big names. But this glamour contained none of our names, none of our faces. The refrain, "This is not your country," echoed for a lifetime. Although we moved around the Watts area, the house on 105th Street near McKinley Avenue held my earliest memories, my earliest fears and questions. It was a small matchbox of a place. Next to it stood a tiny garage with holes through the walls and an unpainted barn-like quality. The weather battered it into a leaning shed. The backyard was a jungle. Vegetation appeared to grow down from the sky. There were banana trees, huge sperm weeds, named that because they stunk like semen when you cut them, foxtails and yellowed grass. An avocado tree grew in the middle of the yard and its roots covered every bit of ground, tearing up cement walks while its branches scraped the bedroom windows. A sway of clothes on some lines filled the little bit of grassy area just behind the house. My brother and I played often in our jungle, even pretending to be Tarzan. Rano mastered the Tarzan yell from the movies. The problem, however, was I usually ended up being the monkey who got thrown off the trees. In fact, I remember my brother as the most dangerous person alive. He seemed to be racked with a scream which never let out. His face was dark with meanness, what my mother called maldad. He also took delight in seeing me writhe in pain, cry, or cower, vulnerable to his own inflated sense of power. This hunger for cruelty included his ability to take my mom's most wicked whippings without crying or wincing. He'd just sit there and stare at a wall, forcing mama to resort to other implements of pain. But Rano would not show any emotion. Yet, in the streets, neighborhood kids often chased Rano from play or jumped him. Many times he came home mangled, his face swollen. Once, somebody threw a rock at him, which cut a gash across his forehead, leaving a scar Rano has to this day. Another time, a neighbor's kid smashed a metal bucket over Rano's head, slicing the skin over his skull and creating a horrifying scene with blood everywhere. My mother, in her broken English, could remedy few of the injustices, but she tried. When this one happened, she ran next door to confront that kid's mother. The woman had been sitting on her porch and saw everything. ¿Qué pasó aquí? Mama asked. I don't know what you want, the woman said. All I know is your boy picked up that bucket and hit himself over the head. That's all I know. In school, they placed Rano in classes with retarded children because he didn't speak much English. They even held him back a year in the second grade. For all this, Rano took his rage out on me. I recall hiding from him when he came around looking for a playmate. My mother actually forced me out of closets with a belt in her hand and made me play with him. One day, we were playing on the rooftop of our house. Grillo, come over here, he said from the roof's edge. Man, look at this on the ground. I should have known better, but I leaned over to see. Rano then pushed me, and I struck the ground on my back with a loud thump and lost my breath, laying deathly still in suffocating agony until I slowly gained it back. Another time, he made me the Indian to his cowboy, tossed a rope around my neck, and pulled me around the yard. He stopped barely before it choked the life out of me. I had rope burns around my neck for a week. His abuse even prompted neighborhood kids to get in on it. One older boy used to see how Rano tore into me. One day, he peered over the fence separating his yard from ours. Hey, little dude, yeah, you. Come over here a minute, he said. I got something to show you. This time, I approached with caution. Little good that did me. I stepped into a loop of rope on the ground. He pulled on it and dragged me through the weeds and foxtails, up the splintery fence, and tied it down on his side. I hung upside down, kicking and yelling for what seemed like hours, until somebody came and cut me down. The house on 105th Street stayed cold. We couldn't always pay the gas or light bills. When we couldn't, we used candles. We cleaned up the dishes and the table where we ate without any light, whispering, because that's what people do in the dark. We took baths in cold water, and I remember wanting to run out of the bathroom as my mother murmured a shiver of words to comfort me. Así es, así será, she explained as she dunked me into the frigid bath. One night, my parents decided to take us to a restaurant since we had no heat to cook anything with. We drove around for a while. On Avalon Boulevard, we found one of those all-night ham, eggs, and coffee places. As we pulled up, I curled up in the seat. No, I don't want to go in, I yelled. And why not, my mother demanded. Por el amor de Dios, aren't you hungry? I pointed a finger to a sign on the door. It read, come in, cold inside. Christmases came with barely a whimper. Once, my parents bought a fake aluminum tree, placed some presents beneath it, and woke us up early to open them up. Most of the wrappings, though, had been haphazardly put together because Rano had sneaked into the living room in the middle of the night and tore them open to take a peek. The presents came from a church group which gave out gifts for the poor. It was our first Christmas. That day, I broke the plastic submarine toy gun and metal car I received. I don't know why. I suppose in my mind, it didn't seem right to have things that were in working.